done. I got contacted by somebody who did not take it. So I'm waiting for them to take it. And as soon as they take it, we'll open them up and release, at the very least, the grades. Not too bad. I wasn't concerned or anything in trouble. The grades were as what I expected because a solid group we got going on here. So there's that. Second, trying to figure out where we were. Papers. Please don't forget about that. That's 20% of your grade. I hate for any of you to get a bad grade just because you kind of messed it up. So please put some effort into it. It should be an easy grade if you are capable of following directions. And not that I want to make any judgment calls against anybody, but I would assume that all of you are capable of following directions because after all, you made it to college. So please make sure you go through everything carefully before you make the drop. And of course, if there's anything on there that you do not understand, ask. And speaking of which, because I'm finding where we were, does anyone have any questions about the paper today? Nothing? Wow, all right. I don't know if I should be filled with confidence or concern. But we will let time bring that to light. Let me see. Rama is here and Garrett is back and Nana's disappeared. But Giselle is here and Abby is here. And Tyler. Tyler's always here. Blake usually comes in late. Paige is here. Lauren is here. Sydney is here. She disappeared. And Joe is with us. All right. Cool beans. Scientific revolution. Everything that we've talked about and we've covered is huge. It really is. Everything we've talked about is historically significant in that it resulted in change. And of course, when you put a little change here, you put a little change there, sometimes that influences bigger areas of change. And the scientific revolution was one of those movements where, for the first time in European history, individuals were trying to figure out with precision how the world worked. Now, we went through last class a bunch of the leading scientists. If any of you have read the book, on the section on the scientific revolution or studied this time period outside of or in other classes, you know, there were many, many, many other individuals. I just happen to give the ones that I think were just the most well-renowned names that you may have heard of, just to make it easier for you. But here's the thing, and this is true in so many areas of life, that in order to become popular, you need people who advocate on your behalf. So, as important as the individual scientists were, there were people in other areas promoting not necessarily the findings, but rather the process. They were championing that's close enough, the process. You know, asking questions, using observation, experimentation. Now, by the way, sometimes people are afraid to ask questions. I don't know why, but they are. Because maybe they're going to feel embarrassed. Or maybe they're nervous. But you can't learn things without asking questions. So the scientists were asking those questions again. We used Galileo as an example of what happened when he didn't even really ask any questions. He just tried writing a book that exposed both sides of an issue. he was labeled a heretic, you know, because of politics. And he basically lost his life's work. But there were other people doing the same thing, championing the cause of this new perception. And I'm going to give you an example again. We're just giving you examples. We're going to give you an example of somebody in the church. We're going to give you an example of somebody in government. And we're going to give you an example of somebody in education. The best advocate that I can present to you in terms of somebody within the church who decided to champion science was an Italian Dominican monk by the name of Giordano Bruno. He, being part of the Dominican order, by the way, the same order that Martin Luther was part of. And if you recall, the primary job of the Dominicans was not to preach, but rather was to research, to archive, to collect knowledge. So just as Luther had the ability to read the works of the conciliarists and Erasmus and Wycliffe and all those guys, Bruno, as being a Dominican, had the ability to read all books that were forbidden. And by the way, he lived in the late 1500s. So he could read Copernicus. He had access to Tycho and Kepler and all of these guys. And most damning for him was the fact that he was a free thinker. He was willing to read anything for the sake of knowledge. Now, one of the dangers that we live in modern society is there are people and powers that be that try pushing us into bubbles. Oh, if you are this kind of person, you must think this way. So you only can read these ideas. Or if you're that kind of person, you only can read those ideas. Well, the problem is if you only get half the story, do you really understand what's going on? Well, he read, of course, the positions of the church, but he also wanted to see the positions of the other people. And he was willing to do so at a time when the church literally was burning people alive. One of the examples from out of the church that got him in trouble was he had access to works that went back to the earliest days of the church. And he was exposed to an early version of Christianity known as Arianism. Nothing to do with the Nazis, nothing to do with the A-R-Y-A-N. Arianism was a philosophical perspective by a former bishop in, I think he was in Alexandria, Arius. And in his view of scripture, he did something that in the 4th century was labeled potentially as controversial. He argued against the Holy Trinity, the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit. Official position of the Catholic Church after the Nicene Council was that God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit was one entity. The Holy Trinity. But Arius argued, hold on there a second. Jesus cannot be one and the same of God, or as God, because God is eternal. God is omnipotent. God is everything and nothing simultaneously.
Jesus, however, was a created being. He came into the form of human flesh. He walked on the earth. He was born, he lived, and he died.
How can he be one and the same as God? Well, it got so crazy that even the Roman Emperor Constantine had to intervene. And he had to use the powers of the state to declare, no, Arianism is heresy. Well, Bruno read this and he was like, well, yeah, that kind of makes sense. That's kind of logical. How can one be identical but different? That makes no sense. Well, he got in trouble. He had to pay penance in the monastery, frequently doing extra laborious tasks. You know, cleaning the piss pots and other miserable jobs as punishment. He also was caught with copies of Erasmus's books in his bed, even though the rector of his monastery forbade it. Because we know what Erasmus wrote about, Praise of Folly, kind of making fun of everybody. And of course, Textus Receptus, that the official Bible of the church could be wrong. Well, needless to say, this free thinker was fascinated by Copernicus's model. He was one of the first people within the church to advocate for the acceptance of heliocentrism. I know, Bing, isn't that brilliant? In fact, he published two philosophical dialogues in which he argued that anyone who sat back and used simple logic could disagree with Copernicus. And to the people who said no, like Tycho Brahe, Earth is too big to move, Bruno argued, stand still and look up. I mean, you can't tell today because we're stuck in a fog bank, but if it's a nice day, do you have the ability to see movement? What moves? Nice day. Blue sky, sun's out. The clouds. You can actually see the Earth movement by watching the clouds go, boom. Now, of course, that's not exactly how it worked. But again, he's using his observation to make a counterargument based on logic. And by the way, do you ever stand outside on a nice day? Just kind of sit back. One of the reasons why I've always loved living in New England is no matter what type of day it is, even if it's hot and humid, if you stand still long enough, you'll feel a breeze. Well, like putting your head out the window and driving. You can feel the impacts of movement. He also, about 100 years before Newton argued it, he also argued that there could be things beyond what you can see with your own eyes. He was one of the first people to argue that the universe just goes on and on and on. He, in his writings, argued that the heavens is filled with pure air. Not air that human beings can consume, but air that doesn't put up resistance to the celestial bodies moving. really got him in trouble was when he looked at our son and juxtaposed our son that has planets going around it and, at least on Earth, has life. He looked up at the sky and saw those dots and said, well, those must be suns too. They just must be far away. And with all of those suns, there has to be planets, which statistically means if you have billions of suns, you could have trillions of planets, and there's got to be at least one out there that has life on. He literally argued that we are not special. Because if there could be other planets and other life, we're not unique anymore. We're just another planet that happens to be flying through the universe with a bunch of soft meat bags on it. As opposed to the position of the church. That Earth is unique and special, and it's where God put man down to prove his worth to obtain a place in heaven. And as if that was not bad enough, he began advocating that the church and the church philosophy, and by the way, that's what religion is. Religion isn't the institution. Religion is the philosophy that the institution uses. Well, he argued that religion should change to reflect scientific findings. Because after all, if God created the universe, should not we worship God's creation based on God's intentions? Right? Well, unfortunately for Bruno, in 1592, he was arrested for heresy in Venice. He was transferred to Rome in 1593, where he was put on trial before the Holy Office. His trial, because he was a monk, because he was a scholar, would last for 7 years. He was given multiple opportunities to recant. Remember, Galileo recanted. But Bruno was so strong in his beliefs, his positions, his principle, he refused to bend. So, Pope Clement VIII would declare him a heretic. He would be found guilty, and he would be sentenced to death on February 17th, 1600, which just so happened to be Ash Wednesday, which is quite ironic. Because Bruno was first subjected to the punishment known as muzzling. What's a muzzle? What? Why do you put it over your mouth? So you don't talk. Well, guess what? They didn't put anything over his mouth. They made it so he couldn't talk. They pulled out his tongue and cut it off. Because he used wicked words. They then cut off all his fingers because he wrote wicked words. And finally, they sentence him to burn at the stake. But because he thought evil thoughts, he was burned upside down. He was burned not just once, he was not burned twice, but he was burned thrice. And his ashes were thrown in the Tiber River. You want to talk about martyrdom for free thought? All of the so-called activists today are laughable because none of them are willing to die for their beliefs. That's true advocacy. In the realm of the government, because don't forget, there was no separation of church and state. Church and state often worked in tangent together. And in the case of England, when Henry VIII started his Protestant Reformation, church and state kind of became one because the king was the head of the church. Well, fast forward to the start of the Stuart dynasty. After the death of Elizabeth I, as we know, James I was crowned king. And his prime minister, Lord Chancellor, was Lord Francis Bacon. Working in the government, he himself was not a scientist, but he was fascinated by the findings of science. And keep in mind, James I became king in 1603. At the same time Bruno was burned at the stake, in and around the same time Galileo was doing his writings. Bacon decided that the government should, to a degree, be involved in creating rules for proper scientific conduct. Out of these rules would develop a methodology, which, if you took science in high school or here, is the core basis of modern science classes. And he is commonly regarded as being the creator of what today we refer to as empiricism. Where you use inductive reasoning to conduct investigations. So, you come up with a hypothesis, and you attempt to observe the natural conditions of what it is you want to figure out. Because once you figure out how it works, then you can begin experimenting and getting different results. Why? Well, you got to make rules, laws. Because if you can figure out how nature works, that could be the foundation upon which the expansion of knowledge can occur. So ultimately, he encouraged scientists to find the truth. Not subjective truth. Not your own personal truth. Because your own personal truth is not truth, it's opinion. No, what he argued for was absolute, irrefutable proof that could be deemed as factual by everybody. Ready for this one? The sun is yellow. The sky is blue. Mountains are big things made out of rocks. The ocean is full of salt water. Simple, basic facts. Because if you can't have agreed upon facts, you can never progress. I mean, imagine trying to play a game of baseball with a bunch of hockey players who want to use rugby rules. couldn't happen. If you're going to play baseball, you have to follow the rules. You're going to play softball, you have to follow the rules. If you're going to play basketball, you have to follow the rules of the game. You just can't make it up. That's all he's saying. But he warned us. Ironically, in the modern age, his warnings are completely ignored. But he warned us of dangers of the pursuit of the truth. In particular, he recognized that there would be certain falsehoods that potentially could distort truth. And these distortions he referred to as idols. And he said there were four of them. Idol number one. That was weird. Idol number one. He called it idols of the tribe. Idols of the tribe. Idols of the tribe, in his own reasoning, was falsehoods common to certain groups, cultures, ethnicities, races, call it what you will. Yes. Idols of the
tribe.
Good. Falsehoods common to certain, we're going to make it unshocking. He used the word race, but his use of race was more like culture. So I think I said falsehoods common to certain groups, races, religions, ethnicities, things along those lines. So, for instance, and I'll give you one that's not shocking. Did you know that there are individuals who believe that the earth is flat? Today, in 2024, there actually is a group called the Flat Earth Society. Despite the fact that you literally have the ability to get on a plane and fly around the earth, or get on a boat and sail across the sea. And when you go up in a plane, what do you see? But the circular curve of the horizon. I mean, literally, you can see it with your own eyes. But there are people who believe that there's a flat earth. Why? Well, because they're part of that group. So no matter what you tell them, they're never going to believe. So it's incapable for them to learn. Idol number two. Idol number two. Idols of the den. The idols of the den. Of course, the den being the home of where bears live, little in caves. Well, idols of the den, Bacon described as being falsehoods that come from individuals. Falsehoods that come from individuals. These are people who claim that they have individual truths and reject when their individual truths are wrong. Now, I'm not going to try to be denigrating in any way, shape, or form. And I'm not a boomer, so don't call me one. I'm a Gen Xer. But this was about 10 years ago. I experienced something that I knew nothing about. I know a little more about it now. No idea about it. So that puts me in my 40s. I actually had a young lady in one of my classes at another college that I used to teach at who came to class as what we commonly refer to as a furry. Till day, she wore little cat ears. She claimed she was a cat. She would sit there and I'd lick her paw in my class. And I sat there and I watched her. And I found it very odd. Now,
I'm not a mean-hearted guy. But I did ask her because I was curious. What's up with this? And she said, I'm a cat. I identify as a cat. And I just sat back and said, good luck getting a job.
Because if a cat woman came into my place of my business and filled out a resume, nope, not gonna happen. Because I'm not buying a litter box. I hate to break it to you. I'm not trying to be mean. You are what biology created you to be. A human being cannot be a cat. Only a cat can be a cat. Dog can't be a cat. Bird can't be a cat. A cat is a cat is a cat. Bird is a bird is a bird. That is biology. That is fact. So, Bacon warned people for truly believing things that were wrong. Because he warned that could result in harm. Physical, emotional harm. That was okay, right? Yeah, I'm not trying to. It was honest. I was just like, what the hell? But that's what it is. All right, three. Idols of the marketplace. Idols of the marketplace. He, by the way, would have a free-for-all in modern society because of social media. Idols are the marketplace, are things that are spread because of the misuse of language. Idols of the marketplace are falsehoods that are spread through the misuse of language. I could give you many controversial examples, but I won't. But I'll leave you with one that I use frequently. Again, not a boomer. Don't call me a boomer. Gen X is way better than the baby boomers. Just saying. Cool. The word cool, for hundreds of years, always referred to as temperature. But when my generation was younger, in the 70s, cool suddenly meant something is okay, something is great, something is fascinating. You know, there's so many words you could use. Well, if you were to say cool to somebody who lived 30 years ago, 40 years ago, have no idea what you're saying. So, Bacon warned people, if you are going to communicate, use your words carefully to avoid confusion. Fourth. And as bad as the first three are, in today's world, maybe the fourth is the worst. Idols of the theater. Idols of the theater. Bacon defined idols of the theater are falsehoods that come from the abuse of authority. Falsehoods that come from the abuse of authority. If someone is an authority, that means they have power over other individuals. And if individuals use those positions of power to force ideas which may not be true on people, that is the worst thing that you can do. Because people will be fearful of learning the truth. And in some instances, they may not even ever have the ability to know the truth because they are doing what they are told out of fear of the consequences. I'll give you another example. So, I also teach at Quinsig, and at Quinsig, I mostly do political science classes. And of course, political science, politics comes in, and we all have our opinions on politics. And I always tell my students, I don't care what you write about. You can be for or against anything you want to talk about, and I will not judge you. The only thing I'm going to grade you on is if you follow the directions of the paper. Same is true with your papers, by the way.
Why? I'm open to everything. I'll listen to everything. It doesn't bother me.
But last semester, I was talking to a student who was passionate about a particular issue and was going to use the topic that they ended up writing about in my class in another class. And the other professor told them no, because that's the wrong ideas. The professor used their position of authority to prevent the pursuit of knowledge because the professor was offended. That's how you stifle thought. And the amazing thing is Bacon wrote this 400 years ago. Think about how different our society would have been, for example, through the pandemic. If all of the truth about what was going on was actually told. Like that the shots aren't going to stop you from getting COVID. Or the masks aren't going to stop you from getting COVID. But they didn't say that. And they punished people. Remember the witch hunt? You could get fired if you didn't get your shot. We were forced to get shots here, although we had the religious exceptions. But faculty members were basically told. Students were told. I don't know if you guys were here during COVID. You were told you had to get the shot or you would not be allowed to come on campus. And it was all based on junk science. So there are consequences to falsity. So never be afraid to find the truth. And if you go into the realm of science, even more so. Scientists should not warp facts for any reason. But rather, scientists should only be focused on the truth. Because if not, it could result in abuse of power. Or corruption. Or even worse, death. So, he argued that science must be open. Science must be free. Science must have human goals. Science must follow rules of, again, the hypothesis, observation, experimentation, but peer review. And if a scientist in pursuing something gets to a point when they realize what they're doing is wrong, they need to stop and go back to square one. So you shouldn't try to create your results, but rather you should be focused on how those results are achieved. And finally, he called for education reform. Which is amazing, because at the time, if you went to school, even in England, which was a Protestant country, all you got was religion. That was the core of learning at colleges and universities. So he argued, well, maybe some of the religion has to give way and give rise to science. People should be encouraged to be free thinkers. People should be taught how to pursue knowledge. Because only through that pursuit can society progress. Questions? Lastly, we had somebody in the church, we had someone in government, lastly, we had someone who's actually a professor during the time of the Scientific Revolution. René Descartes. He was a French philosopher, mathematician, and science. He taught at the University of Paris. Now, in his scientific pursuits, he was concerned about where do you start? What's the baseline? Where do you begin the pursuit of knowledge? And as he looked in academia at the time, he realized that classical education was worthless because at all of the prominent universities, most of the classes were taught by Jesuit priests, and the Jesuit priests only taught what was approved by the church. And of course, most of the focus was on studying whether or not God exists. So, you take a history class, it all begins with God. You take a philosophy class, it's all about God. No matter what area it is, God was in everything. And we're not saying that God's bad. But how can you learn 1 plus 1 equals 2 if you're constantly worrying about God in math? So, he decided not to worry about it, but to start within himself. To start within himself. Because he realized as an individual with intelligence, he had to be able to be sure that he could understand what was in fact fact and what was in fact fiction. So he started with himself. He already did this. And in the end, he realized, well, the only absolute is that God exists, because God is the Father and God is the great master who created the universe. You don't need to spend your time arguing about the existence of God, because the fact that we are here is proof that God exists. Because nothing can come from, or rather strike that, something can't come from nothing. I've been waiting, trust me, my whole life, I've been waiting for one day to come in one of my classes and to look down at a desk and boom, something magically appears. That would be wonderful. Nice Reese's peanut butter cup. Poof, magically appears. No. Right. How about a can of Mr. Pibb? You know what Mr. Pibb is? Is that sort of even exists? Right. Well, that was something I liked once again. Mr. Pibb. How about a bologna and cheese sandwich? Little mayo. Since something cannot come from nothing, the fact that we're all here means something put us here. So, let's not worry about it. Instead, let's deal with going into the realm of what we do not know. And as he started looking around and looking into different areas and subject matter, he realized that really one of the only things that he could prove 100% was that he existed. Because he realized that most knowledge is based upon opinion or perspective. So, it is Descartes who is famous for the expression, I think, therefore I am. He could 100% prove that he existed by having doubts about his own existence. Because if you did not exist, how could you doubt that you existed? That's philosophy. And once he reached that point, he started writing about the power of rational thought.
that once you have your foundation, and once you know what you know, you can use all of your brain capacity to learn about the things a little more about what you don't know. Because after all, why are you going to waste your time learning how to make chocolate chip cookies if you've made dozens and dozens and dozens of batches of chocolate chip cookies throughout your whole life? You're just wasting your time.
So then how do you arrive at truth?
Well,
by testing it with experience. I know I can make chocolate chip cookies, although that's not my best creation.
My best creation is my nanas,
my Italian grandmother's famous cookies, which is a family secret. And I am blessed that I am only one of two people in my entire family that got to spend time with my nana before she passed away, and she told me her secrets.
My kids are pissed. They're like, you better tell us how to make those. I'm like, eh, I might take it to my grave. But I don't need to learn how to cook, because I know how to cook. So what do I spend my time doing? Reading books about things I don't know about. To learn. Now, by the way, Descartes finally, last point, argued that's what should be taught. Once you find the truths, that's what should be taught. And only the truths. Not conjecture, not opinion. Just provable truths. Questions? Deep thoughts at 10 a.m. on a rainy Thursday morning. All right. Now here's the thing. As these guys were going around talking about all these ideas and advocating for science, just as the scientific revolution developed as a result of the Age of Exploration and the Protestant Reformation and the Hundred Years' War and the Conciliarist Movement and everything that we talked about, well, the scientific revolution would begin to impact the production of goods. Human beings, for centuries on end, since the beginning of recorded time, produced things through labor-intensive methods. And generally could only produce limited quantities of whatever they produced. But, following on the heels of the scientific revolution, which began in the 16th century, people involved in the production of the one commodity we all need, food, began experimenting with food production, utilizing empiricism and scientific methodology to figure out how crops grow and to experiment with them and see if they could get more. Beginning in the 18th century, the 1700s, people started messing not only with the seeds that you plant in the ground, but how to raise livestock, animals. Animals to help with the labor and animals to eat. Because if you experiment with breeding, for example, you might be able to produce a cow that has more meat on it. And if you can raise a cow that has more meat on it, that's more food that can be eaten by more people. But it wasn't always that way. No. Up until the 18th century, food production was one of the most critical aspects of life.
existence depended upon it. Because there was no such thing as processed frozen foods. There was no Uber Eats. The only food that you could get your hands on generally was the food that you produced. The vast majority of the population were agricultural laborers. And if they produced food in abundance, populations could grow. Because if there was more food, there was more food to feed more people. But when harvests were bad, there was less food, which resulted in, as we saw, famines, plagues, things like that. Death. So as a result, farmers were terrified to experiment, because if you screwed something up and killed your fields, you were dead. Your family was dead. Plus, the economies were based on agricultural production. They were agrarian economies. What was of value is what you produced, because that's what you traded with people. People didn't have dollars and have coins. There was no paper money. There were no banks. So if you needed to get a shirt, you needed to be able to grow something that the weaver wanted to trade with you to get. So the government wouldn't allow experimentation, because if the harvest was shattered, the economy would implode. And you did have a market. If there was less food, prices for everything went up. Inflation. And as people couldn't afford to buy food, we are again, famine, disease, so forth. So people were terrified, terrified to mess anything up. But about 150 years before, things started changing in and around the time of the 15th century. The 1500s. The time of the Protestant Reformation. The time of Copernicus. For a span of about 150 odd years, beginning in the middle 1500s and going all the way into the 1600s, the global temperatures reached the high point during the 6th century span known as the Little Ice Age, which we talked about. That's when global temperatures plummeted. I think it was like 6 or 7 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, from the low during this period, temperatures bumped up, average about 2 degrees. And the amazing thing is, when it gets a little warmer, it's better conditions to grow food. By the way, that's one of the things that I always laugh about the climate change people. Oh my God, global temperatures are going to go up a degree. Every time global temperatures have gone up, more food has been able to be produced, which means more people can eat well. Proof? What occurred here? Warmer temperatures meant longer growing seasons, which meant it was possible to produce healthier crops, more nutrient-rich, and keep people's bellies full. At the same time, during this span, there was a huge change in diets that was supported by the increase in temperatures. Going back to the beginning of the Little Ice Age, and even before, people primarily ate, bless you. Do I need another one? I'm going to give you a preemptive blessing. How's that? During the Middle Ages, people primarily ate wheat-based food. That was their diet. About 3/4 of it. So imagine day after day, you're eating things like
porridge or gruel or hardtack bread. The reason being is that wheat was one of the few crops that could grow not well but decently during the colder periods. Now, depending upon where you live, about a quarter of your diet could be supplemented with some meat if you raised animals. Or if you live near a water source, you might be able to fish. Or animal-based products. So if you had chickens, you know, you could eat eggs. But that was about it. But thanks to the global warming, climate change, and because of the age of exploration, crops found globally were being imported and planted and grown in Europe. Things like potatoes, not native to Europe. Corn, tomatoes, oranges, and so many other crops. They weren't from here. Rice. Well, not here, but they weren't from Europe. They were actually from over here, the New World. And sometimes they met with political reactions. For instance, I will talk about my favorite spud, the potato. The potato originated in Peru, and it was first brought to Europe by the Spanish. And in and around Spain, the Spanish were willing to adopt the wide-level potatoes. They were willing to grow it, and it would become part of their diet. Interestingly enough, the potato would also spread to Ireland. Well, all throughout the rest of Europe, adoption of the potato was slow. Because unlike nice, shiny fruits and vegetables that grow above ground on plants, where do potatoes come from? The dirt. Yeah, the dirt. So they were seen as dirty. In some instances, they were viewed as poisonous. So because of concerns, countries like France actually made it illegal to grow potatoes. Which is kind of funny. Because when we talk about the French Revolution, there's going to be an outbreak known as the Great Fear. When, because of climate change, weather got really bad, poor harvests, people in France literally were starving to death. But places that had adopted the potato, they were fine. So fine that the Belgians would invent what today we call the French fry. The Belgians did it to mock the French. Because the Belgians had so much food, they were willing to fry it. Which was basically seen as cooking it almost so that way it's not nutrient rich anymore. But the Belgians had so much food, they didn't care. They could make it into a treat. As a way to say, "Nyeh," to the French. And by the way, it was beneficial. Because if you plant an acre of potatoes, in one harvest, you can feed 10 people. But if you plant an acre of wheat, you only can feed 5. So if you're willing to take a risk, you can get more reward. And speaking of more reward, more food meant more babies could be born and have food in their bellies and have a greater chance of growing into adulthood and thus getting married and procreating and making a larger next generation. People were healthier. By eating more diversified foods, they got more vitamins, more nutrients. They were healthier. There were less famines. There were less pandemics. Not only did population boom, Europe in about 1500 had a population estimated to be around 50 million. But by 1800, Just 300 years later, it increased to about 200 million. All because people were eating more food, living longer, being healthier. Oh, age expectancy increased. The average life expectancy in 1500 was 35. My God, I would be dead for almost 20 years. My hair and bones would still be there, but I'd be ugly to look at. What's the life expectancy today? 80, I think. It's all because there's more food being produced. Plus, there was a change in warfare. With the advent and adoption of guns, you didn't need to have big armies lining up on the farmlands and fighting battles and destroying fields. So everything worked to the advantage of more. Prices, as more crops were being produced, slowly began to rise, not rapidly, and profits were being made. Profits that could be reinvested in new ideas, new techniques, new technologies. Because they're willing to take risks. Two of the leading innovators in agricultural production are the Dutch from the Netherlands and the English, obviously from England. Start off with the Dutch. The Dutch had to deal with their terrain. Much of the Netherlands is below sea level. And as a result, the water table is really high. So it doesn't take much digging before you hit water. Well, the Dutch, going back prior to the agricultural revolution, expanded their lands by building massive seawalls, commonly referred to as dikes, to kind of keep the ocean out and to create more open space. But of course, like New Orleans, the water here, the land here, that creates problems. So what the Dutch began doing is dealing with irrigation. They did everything they could to get the water out of where it was wet and spread it to where water was needed. So all throughout the Netherlands are channels to keep the water moving, and the movement's powered by windmills, which basically have like water paddles underneath, pumps, to keep the water moving from where it's too moist to regions where they need water. They also experimented with crops that human beings really don't eat. And while they didn't understand the science of nutrients, they were astounded that wherever they allowed fields to fill up with clover or radishes, that the next year, if they planted a crop that they could eat, it grew better. Because clovers and radishes replenish the soil. They put nutrients back in. And, coincidentally, because human beings don't really like clover, human beings really don't like radishes, you know who do? Moo cows. So, instead of trying to weed the fields when they filled up with the clovers and the radishes, they'd let their livestock graze there. They would eat the turnips and the radishes and all that stuff. And then what would they do? Yeah, they'd poop. Waste. But you know when it became manure? When the farmers went out there and saw all the cow patties and were like, I'm not picking that up, so let's make it disappear. They inadvertently stumbled upon modern fertilization. Oh. And interestingly enough, the Brits, across the English Channel, learned of what the Dutch were doing, and they embraced some of the Dutch ideas, but they added some of their own. One of the most important things to come out of England is the concept of property ownership. What's my land is my land, and what's your land is your land. And how do you know? They created what is known as the closed field system. The closed field system. Back during feudal times, the lord had his manor house. And then in the village next to the manor house where all the peasants lived, the peasants were expected to work the lord's land. So, to a degree, the land was communally worked. All of the land on the property was for the benefit of everybody who lived on the property. Well, as the peasants began demanding rights and there was a movement towards citizenship, the lord started realizing, okay, we don't own the peasants anymore, and many of the peasants are going to move away. So fine, we will start dividing out plots and selling what we don't need. So this field would be mine, and of course you'd take up all of the rocks that were in the field, and you'd make walls of markation, and you would know up to the inch what's your property and what's your neighbor's. Well, if you know how much land you have, you know how much space you can plant, and you can reasonably expect the level of harvest that you can produce. And if you're successful and you make enough money, maybe you can buy the land of your neighbor and add it to your plot. Closed field system. Huge innovation. And they would also, because now it's not just random space, you know what you got, they would attempt to expand the process of field rotation. Instead of planting everything, which could burn out the field, they annually divided it up into quarters. On one quarter for the spring harvest, you would plant wheat. On another quarter, you would plant for the fall, barley. But on another one, you would plant turnips. And on another one, you would plant clover. And then next year, you'd rotate. One would go to three, two would go to one, four would go to two, three would go to four. Rotate. By doing so, they're not burning out the soil, because they're constantly replenishing it. They're giving each quarter at least 2 to 3 years before a crop is planted on there. And they don't kill the land. And because the land is more nutrient rich, with less land, you produce more food. What do you get? Less land, more efficient production, more efficiency, more profitability, a more of a willingness to innovate, to experiment. But now what do you need much less of? Labor. Because you're only planting a quarter of the fields, you don't need as many people working on the fields. So you know what you do to all your peasants? Sayonara, baby. You kick them off the land. But here's the amazing thing. Once they started embracing innovation, they started looking for other ways to produce more. Better tools, for example. They also had more money that they could make investments in. They could take their capital and put it into a business and have it grow and make more money. And as you had desire for more tools or better tools, you had more money going into the production, add to the fact that there's less people working in the fields, and now you have employees. The scientific revolution, the willing to experiment, led to agricultural change, which would culminate in the birth of the Industrial Revolution, which we'll talk about next class. Questions? Guess what I'm going to leave you with? Papers, papers, papers. Stay dry, my friends. We'll see you on Tuesday.